him and his circumstances. And what if this grueling final debauch he committed himself to didn't somehow resolve the problem, would surely have to be called his problem? But he could not even begin to try to see how the image of desiccated impulses floating dryly related to either him or the insect, which had retreated back into its hole in the angled girder, because at this precise time, his telephone and his intercom to the front door's buzzer both sounded at the same time. Both loud and tortured and so abrupt they sounded yanked through a very small hole into the great balloon of colored silence he sat in, waiting. And he moved first toward the telephone console, then over toward his intercom module, then convulsively back toward the sounding phone, and then tried somehow to move toward both at once, finally, so that he stood splay-legged, arms wildly out as if something's been flung, splayed, entombed between the two sounds, without a thought in his head. The 1st of April. Year of the Tux Medicated Pad.
All I know is my dad said to come here.
Come right in. You'll see a chair to your immediate left.
So, I'm here.
That's just fine. 7-Up? Maybe some lemon soda?
I guess not, thanks. I'm just here is all. And I'm kind of wondering why my dad sent me down, you know? Your door there doesn't have anything on it, and I was just at the dentist last week, and so I'm wondering why I'm here exactly is all. That's why I'm not sitting down yet.
You're how old, Hal? 14?
I'll be 11 in June. Are you a dentist? Is this like a dental consult?
You're here to converse.
Converse?
Yes. Pardon me while I key in this age correction. Your father had listed you as 14 for some reason.
Converse as in with you?
You're here to converse with me, Hal, yes. I'm almost going to have to implore you to have some lemon soda. Your mouth is making those dry, sticky, inadequate saliva sounds.
Dr. Zagarelli says that's one reason for all the caries, is that I have low salivary output.
Those dry, sticky, salivaless sounds which can be death to a good conversation.
But I rode my bike all the way up here against the wind just to converse with you? Is the conversation supposed to start with me asking why?
I'll begin by asking if you know the meaning of implore, Hal.
Probably. I'll go ahead and take a 7-Up then if you're going to implore.
I'll ask you again whether you know implore, young sir.
Young sir?
You're wearing that bow tie, after all. Isn't that rather an invitation to a young sir?
Implore's a regular verb, transitive. To call upon, or for, in supplication. To pray to, or for, earnestly. To beseech, to entreat. Weak synonym, urge. Strong synonym, beg. Etymology unmixed. From Latin, implorare. Meaning in, plorare, meaning in this context, to cry aloud. OED, Condensed Volume 6, page 1387, column 12, and a little bit of 13.
Good Lord. She didn't exaggerate, did she?
I tend to get beat up sometimes at the academy for stuff like that. Does this bear on why I'm here? That I'm a continentally ranked junior tennis player who can also recite great chunks of the dictionary? Verbatim, at will, and tends to get beat up, and wears a bow tie? Are you like a specialist for gifted kids? Does this mean they think I'm gifted?
Psst. Here you are, drink up.
Thanks.
You were thirsty.
So then if I sit down, you'll fill me in?
Professional conversationalist knows his mucous membranes, after all.
I might have to burp a little bit in a second from the soda. I'm alerting you ahead of time.
Hal, you are here because I am a professional conversationalist, and your father has made an appointment with me for you to converse.
Oh, excuse me. Tap, 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 tap.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Tap, 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 tap.
You're a professional conversationalist.
I am, yes, as I believe I just stated, a professional conversationalist.
Don't start looking at your watch, as if I'm taking up valuable time of yours. If himself made the appointment and paid for it, the time's supposed to be mine, right? Not yours. And then, but what's that supposed to mean, professional conversationalist?
A conversationalist is just one who converses much. You actually charge a fee to converse much?
A conversationalist is also one who, I'm sure you'll recall, excels in conversation.
That's Webster 7th. It's not the OED.
Tap, tap.
I'm an OED man, doctor.
If that's what you are.
Are you a doctor? Do you have a doctorate?
Most people like to put their diplomas up, I notice, if they have credentials.
And Webster 7th isn't even up to date. Webster's 8th amends to one who converses with much enthusiasm.
Another 7-up?
Is himself still having this hallucination I never speak? Is that why he put the moms up to having me bike up here? Himself is my dad. We call him himself. As in, quote, the man himself. As it were, we call my mother the moms. My brother coined the term. I understand this isn't unusual. I understand most more or less normal families address each other internally by means of pet names and terms and monikers. Don't even think about asking me what my little internal moniker is.
Tap, tap, tap.
But himself hallucinates sometimes lately. You ought to be apprised, was the thrust. I'm wondering why the moms let him send me pedaling up here, uphill against the wind, when I've got a challenge match at 3, to converse with an enthusiast with a blank door and no diplomas anywhere in view.
I, in my small way, would like to think it had as much to do with me as with you, that my reputation preceded me.
Isn't that usually a pejorative clause?
I am wonderful fun to talk to. I'm a consummate professional. People leave my parlor in states. You are here. It's conversation time. Shall we discuss Byzantine erotica?
How did you know I was interested in Byzantine erotica?
You seem persistently to confuse me with someone who merely hangs out a shingle with the word conversationalist on it, and this operation with a fly-by-night one, strung together with chewing gum and twine. You think I have no support staff? Researchers at my beck? You think we don't delve full-bore into the psyches of those for whom we've made appointments to converse? You don't think this fully accredited, limited partnership would have an interest in obtaining data on what informs and stimulates our conversees?
I know only one person who'd ever use full bore in casual conversation.
There is nothing casual about a professional conversationalist and staff. We delve. We obtain. And then some, young sir.
Okay. Alexandrian or Constantinian?
You think we haven't thoroughly researched your own connection with the whole current intra-provincial crisis in southern Quebec?
What intra-provincial crisis in southern Quebec? I thought you wanted to talk racy mosaics.
This is an upscale district of a vital North American metropolis, Hal. Standards here are upscale and high. A professional conversationalist flat-out full-board delves. Do you for one moment think that a professional plier of the trade of conversation would fail to probe, beak deep into your family's sordid liaison with the pan-Canadian resistance's notorious Monsieur Duplessis and his malevolent but allegedly irresistible amanuensis cum operative Luria P?
Listen, are you okay?
Do you?
I'm 10 for Pete's sake. I think maybe your appointment calendar squares got juggled. I'm the potentially gifted 10-year-old tennis and lexical prodigy whose mom's a continental mover and shaker in the prescriptive grammar academic world, and whose dad's a towering figure in optical and avant-garde film circles, and single-handedly founded the Enfield Tennis Academy but drinks wild turkey at like 5 a.m. and pitches over sideways during dawn drills on the court some days, and some days presents with delusions about people's mouths moving but nothing coming out. I'm not even up to J yet in the condensed OED, much less Quebec or malevolent Luria's.
Of the fact that photos of the aforementioned liaison being leaked to Der Spiegel resulted in the bizarre deaths of both an Ottoman paparazzo and a Bavarian international affairs editor, of an alpenstock through the abdomen and an ill-swallowed cocktail onion, respectively?
I just finished Jew's ear. I'm just starting on Jew's harp and the general theory of oral liars. I've never even skied.
That you could dare to imagine we'd fail conversationally to countenance certain weakly, shall we say, maternal assignations with a certain unnamed bisexual bassoonist in the Albertan Secret Guard's tactical bands unit?
Gee, is that the exit over there I see?
That your blithe inattention to your own dear grammatical mother's cavortings with not one, not two, but over 30 Near Eastern medical attachés...
Would it be rude to tell you your mustache is askew?
That her introduction of esoteric mnemonic steroids, stereochemically not dissimilar to your father's own daily hypodermic megavitamin supplement, derived from a certain organic testosterone regeneration compound, distilled by the Hevero shaman of the South Central L.A. Basin into your innocent-looking bowl of morning Ralston.
As a matter of fact, I'll go ahead and tell you your whole face is kind of running, sort of. If you want to check, your nose is pointing at your lap.
That your quote-unquote complimentary Dunlop wide-body tennis rackets, super-secret formulaic composition materials of high modulus, graphite-reinforced, polycarbonate, polybutylene resin, are organochemically identical, I say again, identical, to the gyroscopic balance sensor and the mise-en-scene appropriation card and priapistic entertainment cartridge implanted in your very own towering father's anaplastic cerebrum, after his cruel series of detoxifications and convolution smoothings and gastrectomy and prostatectomy and pancreatectomy and phlectomy,
tap, tap,
could possibly escape the combined investigation attention of...
And it strikes me I've definitely seen that Argyle sweater vest before. That's himself's special Interdependence Day celebratory dinner Argyle sweater vest that he makes a point of never having cleaned. I know those stains. I was there for that clot of veal marsala right there. Is this whole appointment a date-connected thing? Is this April Fool's dad? Or do I need to call the moms and CT?
It requires only daily evidence that you speak, that you recognize the occasional vista beyond your own generous mondragonoid nose's fleshy tip.
You rented a whole office and face for this, but leave your old unmistakable sweater vest on? And how'd you even get down here before me, with the mercury up on blocks after you... Did you fool CT into giving you the keys to a functional car?
Who used to pray daily for the day his own dear late father would sit, cough, open that bloody tissue of the Tucson citizen, and not turn that newspaper into the room's fifth wall? And who, after all this light and noise, has apparently spawned the same silence? Who's lived his whole ruddy, bloody, cruddy life in five-walled rooms?
Dad, I've got a duly scheduled challenge match with Schacht in 12 minutes. Wind at my back downhill or no. I've got this oral neurologist who's going to be outside Brighton Best Savings wearing a pre-designated necktie at straight up 5. I have to mow his lawn for a month for this interview. I can't just sit here watching you think I'm mute while your fake nose points at the floor. And are you hearing me talking, Dad? It speaks. It accepts soda. And defines implore and converses with you.
Praying for just one conversation, amateur or no, that does not end in terror. That does not end like all the others. You staring, me swallowing. Son. Son.
The 9th of May, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Another way fathers impact sons is that sons, once their voices have changed in puberty, invariably answer the telephone with the same locutions and intonations as their fathers. This holds true regardless of whether the fathers are still alive. Because he left his dormitory room before 0600 for dawn drills, and often didn't get back there until after supper,
packing his book bag and knapsack and gear bag for the whole day, together with selecting his best strung rackets. It all took Hal some time. Plus, he usually collected and packed and selected in the dark, and with stealth, because his brother Mario was usually still asleep in the other bed. Mario didn't drill, and couldn't play, and needed all the sleep he could get. Hal held his complimentary gear bag and was putting different pairs of sweats to his face, trying to find the cleanest pair by smell, when the telephone console sounded. Mario thrashed and sat up in bed, a small, hunched shape with a big head against the gray light of the window. Hal got to the console on the second ring and had the transparent phone's antenna out by the third. His way of answering the phone sounded like, yellow?
I want to tell you, the voice on the phone said. My head is filled with things to say.
Hal held three pairs of ETA sweatpants in the hand that didn't hold the phone. He saw his older brother succumb to gravity and fall back limp against the pillows. Mario often sat up and fell back, still asleep.
I don't mind, Hal said softly. I could wait forever.
That's what you think, the voice said. The connection was cut. It had been Orin.
Hey, Hal.
The light in the room was a creepy gray, a kind of non-light. Hal could hear Brandt laughing at something Kenkel had said, off down the hall, on the clank of their janitorial buckets. The person on the phone had been O.
Hey, Hal.
Mario was awake. It took four pillows to support Mario's oversized skull. His voice came from the tangled bedding.
Is it still dark out, or is it me? Go back to sleep. It isn't even six.
Hal put the good leg into the sweatpants first.
Who was it?
Shoving three coverless Dunlop wide bodies into the gear bag and zipping the bag partway up so the handles had room to stick out. Carrying all three bags back over to the console to deactivate the ringer on the phone, he said,
No one you know, I don't think.
Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Though only one-half ethnic Arab and a Canadian by birth and residence, the medical attaché is nevertheless once again under Saudi diplomatic immunity, this time as special ear-nose-throat consultant to the personal physician of Prince Hugh, the Saudi Minister of Home Entertainment, here on northeastern USA soil, with his legation to cut another mammoth deal with Interlace Tel Entertainment. The medical attaché turns 37 tomorrow, Thursday, the 2nd of April, in the North American lunar YDAU, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The legation finds the promotional subsidy of the North American calendar hilariously vulgar, to say nothing of the arresting image of the idolatrous West's most famous and self-congratulating idol, the colossal libertine statue, wearing some type of enormous adult-designed diaper, and hilariously apposite image popular in the news photos of so many international journals. The attaché's medical practice being normally divided between Montreal and the Rub Al-Khali, it is his first trip back to USA soil since completing his residency 8 years ago. His duties here involve migrating with the prince and his retinue between Interlace's two hubs of manufacture and dissemination in Phoenix, Arizona, USA, and Boston, Massachusetts, USA, respectively, offering expert ENT assistance to the personal physician of Prince Q. The medical attaché's particular expertise is the maxillofacial consequences of imbalances in intestinal flora. Prince Q, as would anyone who refuses to eat pretty much anything but Toblerone, suffers chronically from Candida albicans, with attendant susceptibilities to manilial sinusitis and thrush, the yeasty sores and sinal impactions of which require almost daily drainage in the cold and damp of early spring Boston, USA.
a veritable artist, possessed of a deftness nonpareil, with cotton swab and evacuation hypo, the medical attaché is known among the shrinking upper classes of Petro-Arab nations as the Debeki of maxillofacial yeast. His staggering fee scale is holy, ad valorem. Saudi consulting fees in particular are somewhere just past obscene, but the medical attaché's duties on this trip are personally draining and sort of nauseous, and when he arrives back at the sumptuous apartments he had his wife sublet in districts far from the legation's normal Back Bay and Scottsdale digs, at the day's end, he needs unwinding in the very worst way. A more than averagely devout follower of the North American Sufism, promulgated in his childhood by Pir Valayat, the medical attaché partakes of neither kif nor distilled spirits, and must unwind without chemical aid. When he arrives home after evening prayers, he wants to look upon a spicy and 100% Sharia halal dinner, piping hot and arranged and steaming pleasantly on its attractive tray. He wants his bib ironed and laid out by the tray at the ready. And he wants the living room's telepewter booted and warmed up, and the evening's entertainment cartridges already selected and arranged and lined up in dock, ready for remote insertion into the viewer's drive. He reclines before the viewer in his special electronic recliner, and his black-veiled, ethnically Arab wife wordlessly attends him, loosening any constrictive clothing, adjusting the room's lighting, fitting the complexly molded dinner tray over his head so that his shoulders support the tray and allow it to project into space just below his chin, that he may enjoy his hot dinner without having to remove his eyes from whatever entertainment is up and playing. He has a narrow imperial-style beard, which his wife also attends, and keeps free of detritus from the tray just below. The medical attaché sits and watches and eats and watches, unwinding by visible degrees, until the angles of his body in the chair and his head on his neck indicate that he has passed into sleep, at which point his special electronic recliner can be made automatically to recline to full horizontal, and luxuriant silk analog bedding emerges flowing from long slots in the appliance's sides. And, unless his wife is inconsiderate and clumsy with the recliner's remote handheld controls, the medical attaché is permitted to ease effortlessly from unwound spectation into a fully relaxed night's sleep. Still right there in the recumbent recliner, the teepee set to run a recursive loop of low-volume surf and light rain on broad green leaves. Except, that is, for Wednesday nights, which in Boston are permitted to be his wife's Arab Women's Advanced League tennis night with the other legation wives and companions at the plush Mount Auburn Club in West Watertown, on which nights she is not around wordlessly to attend him, since Wednesday is the USA weekday on which fresh Toblerone hits Boston, Massachusetts, USA's Newbury Street's import confectioner's shelves, and the Saudi Minister of Home Entertainment's inability to control his appetites for Wednesday Toblerone often requires the medical attaché to remain in personal attendance all evening on the bulk-rented 14th floor of the Back Bay Hilton, juggling tongue depressors and cotton swabs, Nystadin and ibuprofen and styptics and antibiotic thrush salves, rehabilitating the mucous membranes of the dyspeptic and distressed and often but not always penitent and appreciative Saudi Prince Q. So, on the 1st of April, YDAU, when the medical attaché is, it is alleged, insufficiently deft with a Q-tip on an ulcerated sinal necrosis and is subjected at just 1,800 hours to a fit of febrile thrush of pique from the florally imbalanced Minister of Home Entertainment, and is by high-volume fiat replaced at the royal bedside by the prince's personal physician, who summoned by beeper from the Hilton sauna, and when the damp personal physician pats the medical attaché on the shoulder and tells him to pay the pique no mind, that it's just the yeast talking, but to just head on home and unwind and for once make a well-deserved early Wednesday evening of it, and that so when the attaché does get home at like 1840 hours, his spacious Boston apartments are empty, The living room lights, undimmed. Dinner unheated and the attachable tray still in the dishwasher, and worst. Of course, no entertainment cartridges have been obtained from the Boylston Street Interlace outlet, for the medical attaché's wife, like all the veiled wives and companions of the prince's legatees, has a complimentary goodwill account. And even if he weren't far too exhausted and tightly wound to venture back into the damp, urban night to pick up entertainment cartridges, the medical attaché realizes that his wife has, as always on Wednesdays, taken the car with the diplomatic immunity license plates, without which your thinking alien wouldn't even dream of trying to park publicly at night in Boston, Massachusetts, USA. The medical attaché's unwinding options are thus severely constricted. The living room's lavish teepee receives also the spontaneous disseminations of the Interlace subscription pulse matrix. But the procedures for ordering specific spontaneous pulses from the service are so technologically and cryptographically complex that the attaché has always left the whole business to his wife. On this Wednesday night, trying buttons and abbreviations almost at random, the attaché is able to summon up only live USA professional sports, which he has always found brutish and repellent. Texaco Oil Company sponsored opera, which the attaché has seen today more than enough of the human uvula, thank you very much. A re-disseminated episode of the popular afternoon Interlace children's program, Mr. Bouncity Bounce, which the attaché thinks for a moment might be a documentary on bipolar mood disorders, until he catches on and thumbs the selection panel hastily. And a re-disseminated session of the scantily clad variable impact early AM Fit Forever home aerobics series of the Interlace aerobics guru, Ms. Tony Kondo, the scantily clad and splay-limbed immodesty of which threatens the devout medical attaché with the possibility of impure thoughts. The only entertainment cartridges anywhere in the apartment, a foul-tempered search reveals, are those which have arrived in Wednesday's USA postal delivery, left on the sideboard in the living room, along with personal and professional faxes, and mail the medical attaché declines to read, until it's been pre-scanned by his wife for relevant interest to himself. The sideboard is against the wall opposite the room's electronic recliner under a triptych of high-quality Byzantine erotica. The padded cartridge mailers, with their distinctive rectangular bulge, are mixed haphazardly in with the less entertaining mail. Searching for something to unwind with, the medical attaché tears the different padded mailers open along their designated perforations. There is an ONANMA specialty service film on actinomycete-class antibiotics and irritable bowel syndrome. There is the April 1st YDAU's CBC Pathé North American News Summary 40-minute cartridge, available daily by a wife's auto-subscription, and either transmitted to TP by unrecordable Interlace pulse, or express-posted on a single-play ROM self-erasing disc. There is the Arabic-language video edition of April's Self magazine for the attaché's wife, Nasa's covers modeled chastely swathed and veiled. There is a plain brown and irritatingly untitled cartridge case in a featureless white 3-day standard USA first-class padded cartridge mailer. The padded mailer is postmarked Suburban Phoenix area in Arizona, USA, and the return address box has only the term Happy Anniversary, with a small, drawn, crude face smiling in ballpoint ink instead of a return address or incorporated logo. Though by birth and residence a native of Quebec, where the language of discourse is not English, the medical attaché knows quite well that the English word anniversary does not mean the same as birthday. And the medical attaché and his veiled wife were united in the eyes of God and prophet not in April, but in October, 4 years prior, in the Rubal Khali. Adding to the padded mailer's confusion is the fact that anything from Prince Q's legation in Phoenix, Arizona, USA, would carry a diplomatic seal instead of routine ONAN postage. The medical attaché, in sum, feels tightly wound and badly underappreciated and is prepared in advance to be irritated by the item inside, which is merely a standard black entertainment cartridge, but is wholly unlabeled, and not in any sort of colorful or informative or inviting cartridge case, and has only another of these vapid USA-type circular smiling heads embossed upon it where the registration and duration codes are supposed to be embossed. The medical attaché is puzzled by the cryptic mailer and face and case and unlabeled entertainment, and preliminarily irritated by the amount of time he's had to spend upright at the sideboard attending to mail, which is not his task. The sole reason he does not throw the unlabeled cartridge in the waste can or put it aside for his wife to preview for relevance is because there are such woefully slim entertainment pickings on his wife's irritating, Americanized tennis league evening away from her place at home. The attaché will pop the cartridge in and scan just enough of its contents to determine whether it is irritating or of an irrelevant nature and not entertaining or engaging in any way. He will heat the prepared halal lamb and spicy halal garnish in the microwave oven until piping hot, arrange it attractively on his tray, preview the first few moments of the puzzling and or irritating or possibly mysteriously blank entertainment cartridge first, then unwind with the news summary. Then perhaps have a quick, unlibidinous look at NASA's spring line of sexless black devout women's wear. Then we'll insert the recursive Surf and Rain cartridge and make a well-deserved early Wednesday evening of it, hoping only that his wife will not return from her tennis league in her perspiration-dampened black ankle-length tennis ensemble and remove his dinner tray from his sleeping neck in a clumsy or undeft fashion that will awaken him, potentially. When he settles in with the tray and cartridge, the TP's viewer's digital display reads 1927 hours. Year of the Trial Size Dove Bar.
Wardine say her mama ain't treat her right. Reginald, he come round to my blacktop at my building where me and Dolores Epps jump double dutch, and he say, Clinette, Wardine be down in my crib, cry say her mama ain't treat her right. And I go on with Reginald to his building where he live at, and Wardine be sit deep far back in a closet in Reginald's crib, and she be cry. Reginald gone lift Wardine out the closet, and me with him crying, and I be rub on the wet all over Wardine's face. And Reginald be so careful when he took off all her shirts she got on. Tell Wardine to let me see. Wardine back, all beat up and cut up. Big stripes are cut all up and down Wardine back. Pink stripes and around the stripes of skin like the skin on folks' lips be like. Sick down in my insides to look at it. Wardine be cry. Reginald say Wardine say her mama ain't treat her right. Say her mama beat Wardine with a hanger. Say Wardine mama, man, Roy, Tony, we want to lie down with Wardine. We give Wardine candy and fines. We stand in her way in Wardine's face and he ain't let her pass without he all the time touching her. Reginald say Wardine say Roy, Tony at night when Wardine mama at work. He come into the mattresses where Wardine and William and Chantel and Roy the baby sleep at. And he stand there in the dark, high, and say quiet things at her. And breathe. Wardine mama say Wardine tempt Roy Tony into sin. Wardine say, she say Wardine try to take away Roy Tony into evil and sin with her young tight self. She beat Wardine back with hangers out the closet. My mama say Wardine mama now riding her head. My mama scared of Roy Tony. Wardine be cry. Reginald, he down and beg for Wardine to tell Reginald mama how Wardine mama treat Wardine. Reginald say he love his Wardine. Say he love but ain't never before this time could understand why Wardine won't lie down with him like girls do their man. Say Wardine ain't never let Reginald take off her shirts until tonight. She come to Reginald's crib in his building and be cry. And she let Reginald take off her shirts to see how Wardine mama beat Wardine because Roy Tony. Reginald love his Wardine. Wardine be like to die scared. She say no to Reginald beg. She say if she go to Reginald mama, then Reginald mama go to Wardine mama. Then Wardine mama think Wardine be lie down with Reginald. Wardine say her mama say, Wardine, let a man lie down before she's 16, and she beat Wardine to death. Reginald say he ain't no way gonna let that happen to Wardine. Roy Tony killed Dolores Epps' brother, Columbus Epps, at the Brighton Projects 4 years gone. Roy Tony on parole. Wardine say he show Wardine he got something on his ankle, sent radio signals to parole, that he's still here in Brighton. Roy Tony can't be leave Brighton. Roy Tony brother be Wardine father. He gone. Reginald try to hush Wardine, but he cannot stop Wardine cry. Wardine look like crazy, she's so scared. She say she kill herself if me or Reginald tell our mamas. She say, Clinette, you my half sister. I am beg you that you do not tell your mama or my mama and Roy Tony. Reginald tell Wardine to hush herself and lie down quiet. He put shed spread out the kitchen on Wardine cuts on her back. He run his finger with grease so careful down pink lines of her getting beat with her hanger. Wardine say she do not feel nothing on her back ever since spring. She lies stomach on Reginald's floor and say she ain't got no feeling in the skin of her back. When Reginald gone to get the water, she asked me the truth. How bad is her back look when Reginald look at it? Is she still pretty? She cry. I ain't tell my mama on Wardine and Reginald and Wardine mama and Roy Tony. My mama scared of Roy Tony. My mama be the lady Roy Tony killed Columbus Epps over 4 years gone in the Brighton Projects for love. But I know Reginald tell. Reginald say he gonna die before Wardine mama beat Wardine again. He say he take himself up to Roy Tony and say him not to mess with Wardine or breathe by her mattress at night. He say he take himself on down to the playground at the Brighton Projects where Roy Tony do business. And he go to Roy Tony man to man and he make Roy Tony make it all right. But I think Roy Tony gonna kill Reginald if Reginald go. I think Roy Tony gonna kill Reginald. And then Wardine mama beat Wardine to death with a hanger. And then nobody knows except me. And I'm gonna have a child. In the 8th American educational grade, Bruce Green fell dreadfully in love with a classmate who had the unlikely name of Mildred Bonk. The name was unlikely because if ever an eighth grader looked like a Daphne Christensen or a Kimberly St. Simone or something like that, it was Mildred Bonk. She was the kind of fatally pretty and nubile wraith-like figure who glides through the sweaty junior high corridors of every nocturnal emitter's dreamscape. Hair that Green had heard described by an overwrought teacher as flaxen, a body which the fickle angel of puberty, the same angel who didn't even seem to know Bruce Green's zip code, had visited, kissed, and already left back in 6th. Legs which not even orange keds with purple glitter-encrusted laces could make unserious. Shy, iridescent, coltish, pelvically infractious, amply busted, given to diffident movements of hand brushing flaxen hair from front of dear, creamy forehead, movements which drove Bruce Green up a private tree. A vision in a sundress and silly shoes. Mildred L. Bonk. And then, but by 10th grade, in one of those queer, when-did-that-happen metamorphoses, Mildred Bonk had become an imposing member of the frightening Winchester High School set that smoked full-strength Marlboros in the alley between senior and junior halls and that left school altogether at lunchtime, driving away in loud, low-slung cars to drink beer and smoke dope, driving around with sound systems of illegal wattage, using Visine and Clorette, etc. She was one of them. She chewed gum, or worse, in the cafeteria. Her dear, diffident face now a bored mask of attitude. Her flaxen locks now teased and gelled into what looked, for all the world, like the consequence of a finger stuck into an electric socket. Bruce Green saved up for a low-slung old car and practiced attitude on the aunt who'd taken him in. He developed a will. And by the year of what would have been graduation, Bruce Green was way more bored, imposing, and frightening than even Mildred Bonk. And he and Mildred Bonk and tiny, incontinent Harriet Bonk Green
lived just off the Alston Spur in a shiny house trailer with another frightening couple and with Tommy Ducey, the infamous hair-lipped pot-and-sundries dealer who kept several large snakes in unclean, uncovered aquaria, which smelled, which Tommy Ducey didn't notice because his upper lip completely covered his nostrils, and all he could smell was lip. Mildred Bonk got high in the afternoon and watched cereal cartridges, and Bruce Green had a steady job at Leisure Time Ice. And for a while, life was more or less one big party. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment.
Hal? Hey, Hal.
Yes, Mario?
Are you asleep?
Boo-boo, we've been over this. I can't be asleep if we're talking.
That's what I thought.
Happy to reassure you.
Boy, were you on today. Boy, did you ever make that guy look sick. When he hit that one down the line and you got it and fell down and hit that drop volley, Pamela said the guy looked like he was going to be sick all over the net, he said.
Boo, I kicked that kid's ass is all. End of story. I don't think it's good to rehash it when I've kicked somebody's ass.
It's like a dignity thing.
I think we should just let it sort of lie in state, quietly. Speaking of which...
Hey, Hal?
It's late, Mario. It's sleepy time. Close your eyes and think fuzzy thoughts.
That's what the moms always says, too.
Always work for me, Boo.
I think fuzzy thoughts all the time. You let me room with you because you feel sorry for me.
Boo-boo, I'm not even going to dignify that. I'll regard it as, like, a warning sign. You always get petulant when you don't get enough sleep. And here we are seeing petulance already on the western horizon, right here.
When I asked if you were asleep, I was going to ask if you felt like you believed in God today out there when you were so on, making that guy look sick. This again?
Really don't think midnight in a totally dark room, with me so tired my hair hurts, and drills in 6 short hours, is the time and place to get into this, Mario.
You ask me this once a week. You never say is why.
So tonight, to shush you, how about if I say, I have administrative bones to pick with God, Boo? I'll say God seems to have a kind of laid-back management style I'm not crazy about. I'm pretty much anti-death. God looks, by all accounts, to be pro-death.
I'm not seeing how we can get together on this issue, he and I, Boo. You're talking about since himself passed away. See? You never say.
I do, too, say. I just did. I just didn't happen to say what you wanted to hear, Boo-Boo, is all. There's a difference.
I don't get how you couldn't feel like you believed today out there. It was so right there. You moved like you totally believed. How do you feel inside not?
Mario, you and I are mysterious to each other.
We countenance each other from either side of some unbridgeable difference on this issue. Let's lie very quietly and ponder this.
Al?
Hey, Hal.
I'm going to propose that I tell you a joke, Boo, on the condition that afterward you shush and let me sleep.
Is it a good one?
Mario, what do you get when you cross an insomniac, an unwilling agnostic, and a dyslexic?
I give.
You get somebody who stays up all night torturing himself mentally over the question of whether or not there's a dog.
That's a good one.
Shush.
Hey, Hal, what's an insomniac?
Somebody who rooms with you, kid, that's for sure.
Hey, Hal, how come the moms never cried when himself passed away? I cried. And you, even CT cried. I saw him personally cry. You listened to Tosco over and over and cried and said you were sad. We all were.
Hey, Hal, did the mom seem like she got happier after himself passed away to you?
It seems like she got happier. She seems even taller. She stopped traveling everywhere all the time for this and that thing. The corporate grammar thing. The library protest thing. Now she never goes anywhere, Boo. Now she's got the headmaster's house and her office and the tunnel in between and never leaves the grounds. She's a worse workaholic than she ever was. And more obsessive-compulsive. When's the last time you saw a dust mote in that house?
Hey, Hal?
Now she's just an agoraphobic workaholic and obsessive-compulsive. This strikes you as happification?
Her eyes are better. They don't seem as sunk in. They look better. She laughs at CT way more than she laughed at himself. She laughs from lower down inside. She laughs more. Her jokes she tells are better ones than yours even now, a lot of the time. How come she never got sad?
She did get sad, Boo-Boo. She just got sad in her way instead of yours and mine. She got sad, I'm pretty sure.
Hal?
Do you remember how the staff lowered the flag to half-mast out in front of the portcullis here after it happened? Do you remember that? And it goes to half-mast every year at convocation? Remember the flag, Boo?
Hey, Hal?
Don't cry, Boo-Boo. Remember the flag only halfway up the pole? Boo-Boo, there are two ways to lower a flag to half-mast. Are you listening? Because no shit, I really have to sleep here in a second, so listen. One way to lower the flag to half-mast is just to lower the flag. There's another way, though. You can also just raise the pole. You can raise the pole to like twice its original height. You get me? You understand what I mean, Mario?
Hell.
She's plenty sad, I bet. At 2010 hours, on the 1st of April, YDAU, the medical attaché is still watching the unlabeled entertainment cartridge. October, year of the Depend adult undergarment. For Orin and Candenza, number 71, morning is the soul's night, the day's worst time, psychically. It cranks the condo's AC way down at night and still most mornings wakes up soaked, fetally curled, entombed in that kind of psychic darkness where you're dreading whatever you think of. Hal Incandenza's brother Orin wakes up alone at 0730 hours amid a damp scent of ambush, and on the other side's dented pillow a note with a phone number and vital data in a loopy schoolgirlish hand. There's also ambush on the note. His side of the bed is soaked. Orin makes honey toast, standing barefoot at the kitchen counter wearing briefs and an old academy sweatshirt with the arms cut off, squeezing honey from the head of a plastic bear. The floor so cold it hurts his feet, but the double-pane window over the sink is hot to the touch. The beastly Metro Phoenix October AM heat just outside. Home with the team, no matter how high the AC or how thin the sheet, Orin wakes with his own impression sweated darkly into the bed beneath him, slowly drying all day to a white, salty outline, just slightly off from the week's other faint, dried outlines. So his fetal-shaped, fossilized image is fanned out across his side of the bed like a deck of cards, just overlapping, like an acid trail or timed exposure. The heat just past the glass doors tightens his scalp. He takes breakfast out to a white iron table by the condo complex's central pool and tries to eat it there, in the heat, the coffee not steaming or cooling. He sits there in dumb animal pain. He has a mustache of sweat. A bright beach ball floats and bumps against one side of the pool. The sun, like a sneaky keyhole view of hell. No one else out here. The complex is a ring with a pool and deck and jacuzzi in the center. Heat shimmers off the deck like fumes from fuel. There's that mirage thing where the extreme heat makes the dry deck look wet with fuel. Orin can hear cartridge viewers going from behind closed windows. that aerobics show every morning, and also someone playing an organ, and the older woman who won't ever smile back at him in the apartment next to his doing operatic scales, muffled by drapes and sun curtains and double panes. The jacuzzi chugs and foams. The note from last night's subject is on violet bond, once folded, and with a circle of darker violet dead center where the subject's perfume spritzer had hit it. The only interesting thing about the script, but also depressing, is that every single circle, O's, D's, P's, and numbers 6 and 8, is darkened in, while the I's are dotted not with circles, but with tiny little Valentine hearts, which are not darkened in. Orne reads the note while he eats toast. That's mainly an excuse for the honey. He uses his smaller right arm to eat and drink. His oversized left arm and big left leg remain at rest at all times in the morning. A breeze sends the beach ball skating all the way across the blue pool to the other side, and Orne watches its noiseless glide. The white iron tables have no umbrellas, and you can tell where the sun is without looking. You can feel right where it is on your body and project from there. The ball moves tentatively back out toward the middle of the pool and then stays there, not even bobbing. The same small breezes make the rotted palms along the condominium complex's stone walls rustle and click, and a couple of fronds detach and spiral down, hitting the deck with a slap. All the plants out here are malevolent, heavy, and sharp. The parts of the palms above the fronds are tufted in sick stuff like coconut hair. Roaches and other things live in the trees. Rats, maybe. Loathsome high-altitude critters of all kinds. All the plants either spiny or meaty. Cacti in queer, tortured shapes. The tops of the palms like Rod Stewart's hair from days gone by. Orne returned with the team from the Chicago game 2 nights ago, Red Eye. He knows that he and the place kicker are the only 2 starters who are not still in terrible pain, physically, from the beating. The day before they left, so like 5 days ago, Orne was out by himself in the jacuzzi by the pool late in the day, caring for the leg, sitting in the radiant heat and bloody late-day light with the leg in the jacuzzi, absently squeezing the tennis ball he still absently squeezes out of habit, watching the jacuzzi funnel and bubble and foam around the leg. And out of nowhere, a bird had all of a sudden fallen into the jacuzzi, with a flat, matter-of-fact plop, out of nowhere, out of the wide, empty sky. Nothing overhung the jacuzzi but sky. The bird seemed to have just had a coronary or something and flight and died and fallen out of the empty sky and landed dead in the jacuzzi, right by the leg. He brought his sunglasses down onto the bridge of his nose with a finger and looked at it. It was an undistinguished kind of bird, not a predator, like a wren, maybe. It seems like no way could it have been a good sign. The dead bird bobbed and barrel rolled in the foam, sucked under 1 second and reappearing the next, creating an illusion of continued flight. Orne had inherited none of the mom's phobias about disorder, hygiene. Not crazy about bugs, though. Roaches. But he just sat there squeezing the ball, looking at the bird without a conscious thought in his head. By the next morning, waking up, curled and entombed, it seemed like it had to have been a bad sign, though. Orne now always gets the shower so hot it's to where he can just barely stand it. The condo's whole bathroom is done in this kind of minty yellow tile he didn't choose, maybe chosen by the free safety who lived here before the Cardinals sent New Orleans the free safety, 2 reserve guards and cash for Orne Incandenza, punter. And no matter how many times he has the Terminex people out, there are still the enormous roaches that come out of the bathroom drains. Sewer roaches, according to Terminex. Blataria implacablus, or something. Really huge roaches. Armored vehicle-type bugs. Totally black with Kevlar-type cases. The works. And fearless. Raised in the Hobbesian sewers down there. Boston's and New Orleans' little brown roaches were bad enough, but you could at least come in and turn on the light and they'd run for their lives. These Southwest sewer roaches, you turn on the light, and they just look up at you from the tile like, "You got a problem?" Oren stomped on one of them, only once, that had come up hellishly out of the drain in the shower when he was in there, showering, going out naked and putting shoes on and coming in and trying to conventionally squash it, and the result was explosive. There's still material from that one time in the tile grouting. It seems unremovable. Roach innards. Sickening. Throwing the shoes away is preferable to looking at the sole to clean it. Now, he keeps big glass tumblers in the bathroom, and when he turns on the light and sees a roach, he puts a glass down over it, trapping it. After a couple of days, the glass is all steamed up and the roach has asphyxiated, messlessly, and Oren discards both the roach and the tumbler in separate sealed Ziplocs in the dumpster complex by the golf course up the street. The yellow tile floor of the bathroom is sometimes a little obstacle course of glasses with huge roaches dying inside, stoically, just sitting there, the glasses gradually steaming up with roach dioxide. The whole thing makes Oren sick. Now he figures the hotter the shower's water, the less chance any small armored vehicle is going to feel like coming out of the drain while he's in there. Sometimes they're in the bowl of the toilet first thing in the a.m., dog paddling, trying to get to the side and climb up. He's also not crazy about spiders, though more like unconsciously. He's never come anyplace close to the conscious horror himself had somehow developed about the Southwest's black widows and their chaotic webs. The widows are all over the place, both here and Tucson, spottable on all but the coldest nights, their dusty webs without any kind of pattern, plotting just about any right-angled place that's dim or out of the way. Terminex's toxins are more effective on the widows. Oren has them out monthly. He's on like a subscription plan over at Terminex. Oren's special conscious horror, besides heights and the early morning, is roaches. There had been parts of Metro Boston near the bay he'd refused to go to as a child. Roaches give him the howling phantods. The parishes around N.O. had been having a spate or outbreak of a certain Latin-origin breed of sinister tropical flying roaches that were small and timid but could fucking fly, and that kept being found swarming on New Orleans infants at night, in their cribs, especially infants in, like, tenements or squalor, and that reportedly fed on the mucus in the baby's eyes, some special sort of optical mucus, the stuff of fucking nightmares. Mobile flying roaches that wanted to get at your eyes as an infant and were reportedly blinding them. Parents had come in the ghastly AM tenement light and find their infants blind, like a dozen blinded infants that last summer. And it was during this spate or nightmarish outbreak, plus July flooding that sent over a dozen nightmarish dead bodies from a hilltop graveyard, sliding all gray-blue down the incline, Oren and two teammates had their townhouse on, in suburban Chalmette, shedding limbs and innards all the way down the hillside's mud, and one morning coming to rest against the post of their roadside mailbox when Oren came out for the morning paper, that Oren had had his agent put out the trade feelers. And so, to the glass canyons and merciless light of Metro Phoenix, in a kind of desiccated circle, near the Tucson of his own father's desiccated youth. It's the mornings after the spider and heights dreams that are the most painful, that it takes sometimes 3 coffees and 2 showers and sometimes a run to loosen the grip on his soul's throat. And these post-dream mornings are even worse if he wakes up unalone, if the previous night's subject is still there, wanting to twitter or to cuddle and like spoon, asking what exactly is the story with the foggy inverted tumblers on the bathroom floor, commenting on his night sweats, clattering around in the kitchen, making kippers or bacon or something even more hideous and unhoneyed he's supposed to eat with post-coital male gusto. The ones who have this thing about, they call it, feeding my man, wanting a man who can barely keep down AM honey toast to eat with male gusto, elbows out and shoveling, making little noises. Even when alone, able to uncurl alone and sit up slowly and wring out the sheet and go to the bathroom, these darkest mornings, stark days that Oren can't even bring himself for hours to think about how he'll get through the day. These worst mornings with cold floors and hot windows and merciless light. The soul's certainty that the day will have to be not traversed, but sort of climbed vertically. And then that going to sleep again at the end of it will be like falling again off something tall and sheer. So, now his own eye mucus is secure in the desert southwest, but the bad dreams have gotten worse since the trade to this blasted area himself had fled long ago as an unhappy youngster. As a nod to Oren's own unhappy youth, all the dreams seem to open briefly with some sort of competitive tennis situation. Last night's it started with a wide-angle shot of Oren on a hard-true court, waiting to receive serve from someone vague, some academy person. Ross Reet, maybe, or good old M. Bain, or gray-toothed Walt Fletchett, now a teaching pro in the Carolinas. When the dream's screen tightens on him and abruptly dissolves to the blank dark rose color of eyes closed against bright light, and there's the ghastly feeling of being submerged and not knowing which way to head for the surface and air, and after some interval the dreams Oren struggles up from this kind of visual suffocation to find his mother's head, Mrs. Avril M. T. Incandenses, the mom's disconnected head, attached face to face to his own fine head, strapped tight to his face somehow by a wraparound system of V.S., high-pro, top-shelf, lamb-gut string from his academy racket's own face, so that no matter how frantically Oren tries to move his head, or shake it side to side, or twist up his face, or roll his eyes, he's still staring at, into, and somehow through his mother's face. As if the mom's head was some sort of overtight helmet Oren can't wrestle his way out of.
2.
In the dream, it's understandably vital to Oren that he disengage his head from this phylactery-ish bind of his mother's disembodied head, and he cannot. Last night's subject's note indicates that at some point last night, Oren had clutched her head with both hands and tried to sort of stiff-arm her, though not in an ungentle or complaining way. The note, not the stiff-arm. The apparent amputation of Mom's head from the rest of the mom's appears in the dream to be clean and surgically neat. There is no evidence of a stump, or any kind of nubbin of neck, even. And it is as if the base of the round, pretty head had been sealed, and also sort of rounded off so that her head is a large living ball, a globe with a face attached to his own head's face. The subject after Bane's sister, but before the one just before this one, with the ambush scent and the hearts over eyes, the previous subject had been a sallowly pretty Arizona State developmental psychology grad student with 2 kids and outrageous alimony and pensions for sharp jewelry, refrigerated chocolate, interlace educational cartridges, and professional athletes who thrashed in their sleep. Not real bright. She thought the figure he'd trace without thinking on her bare flank after sex was the numeral 8, to give you an idea. Their last morning together, right before he'd mailed her child an expensive toy and then had his phone number changed, he'd awakened from a night of horror show dreams, woke up with an abrupt fetal spasm, unrefreshed and benighted of soul, his eyes wobbling and his wet silhouette on the bottom sheet like a coroner's chalk outline. He woke to find the subject up and sitting up against the reading pillow, wearing his sleeveless academy sweatshirt and sipping hazelnut espresso and watching, on the cartridge viewing system that occupied half the bedroom's south wall, something horrific called Interlace Educational Cartridges in conjunction with CBC Educational Programming Matrix presents Schizophrenia, Mind or Body. And it had to lie there, moist and paralyzed, curled fetal on his own sweat shadow, and watch on the viewer, a pale young guy about Hal's age, with copper stubble, and a red cowlick and flat, blank, effectless black doll's eyes stare into space, stage left, while a brisk Albertan voiceover explained that Fenton here was a dyed-in-the-wool paranoid schizophrenic who believed that radioactive fluids were invading his skull and that hugely complex high-tech type machines had been specially designed and programmed to pursue him without cease until they caught him and made brutal sport of him and buried him alive. It was an old, late-millennial CBC Public Interest Canadian news documentary, digitally sharpened and re-disseminated under the Interlace imprimatur. Interlace could get kind of seedy and low-rent during early morning off-hours in terms of spontaneous disseminations. And so, but since the old CBC documentary's thesis was turning out pretty clearly to be schizophrenia body, the voiceover evinced great clipped good cheer as it explained that, well, yes, poor old Fenton here was more or less hopeless as an extra-institutional functioning unit, but that, on the upside, science could at least give his existence some sort of meaning by studying him very carefully to help learn how schizophrenia manifested itself in the human body's brain. That, in other words, with the aid of cutting-edge positron emission tomography, or PET technology, since supplanted wholly by invasive digitals, Orin hears the developmental psychology graduate student mutter to herself, watching rapt over her cup, unaware that Orin's paralytically awake. They could scan and study how different parts of poor old Fenton's dysfunctional brain emitted positrons in a whole different topography than your average hale and hearty, non-delusional, God-fearing Albertan's brain. Advancing science by injecting test subject Fenton here with a special blood-brain barrier-penetrating radioactive dye, and then sticking him in the rotating body-sized receptacle of a PET scanner. On the viewer, it's an enormous gray metal machine that looks like something co-designed by James Cameron and Fritz Lang. And now have a look at this Fenton fellow's eyes as he starts to get the gist of what the voiceover is saying. And in a terse old public TV cut, they now showed subject Fenton in five-point canvas restraints whipping his copper-haired head from side to side as guys in mint-green surgical masks and caps inject him with radioactive fluids through a turkey baster-sized syringe. Then, good old Fenton's eyes bugging out in total foreseen horror as he's rolled toward the huge gray PET device and slid like an unrisen loaf into the thing's open maw until only his decay-colored sneakers are in view. And the body-sized receptacle rotates the test subject counterclockwise with brutal speed so that the old sneakers point up and then left and then down and then right and then up faster and faster. The machine's blurps and tweets not even coming close to covering Fenton's entombed howls as his worst delusional fears came true in digital stereo, and you could hear the last surviving bits of his functional, dye-permeated mind being screamed out of him for all time as the viewer digitally superimposed an image of Fenton's ember-red and neutron-blue brain in the lower right corner, where Interlace's time-temp functions usually appear, and the brisk voiceover gave capsule histories of first paranoid schizophrenia, and then PET. With Orin lying there, slit-eyed, wet and neuralgic, with AM dread, wishing the subject would put her own clothes and sharp jewelry on and take the rest of her Toblerone out of the freezer and go, so he could go to the bathroom and get yesterday's asphyxiated roaches into an EWD dumpster before the dumpster's all filled for the day, and decide what kind of expensive present to mail the subject's kid. And then, the matter of the dead bird, out of nowhere. And then, news of pressure from the AZ Cardinal Administration to cooperate with some sort of insipid-type personality profile series of interviews with some profiler from Moment Magazine, with personal backgroundish questions to be answered in some blandly sincere team PR way, the unexamined stress of which drives him to start calling Haley again. Reopen that whole Pandora's box of worms. Orin also shaves in the shower. Face red with heat, wreathed in steam, by feel, shaving upward with south to north strokes as he was taught. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Here's Hal in Condensa. Age 17, with his little brass one-hitter, getting covertly high in the Enfield Tennis Academy's underground pump room and exhaling palely into an industrial exhaust fan. It's the sad little interval after afternoon matches and conditioning, but before the Academy's communal supper. Hal is by himself down here, and nobody knows where he is or what he's doing. Hal likes to get high in secret, but a bigger secret is that he's as attached to the secrecy as he is to getting high. A one-hitter, sort of like a long FDR-type cigarette holder whose end is packed with a pinch of good dope, gets hot and is hard on the mouth, the brass ones especially. But one-hitters have the advantage of efficiency. Every particle of ignited pot gets inhaled. There's none of the incidental second-hand type smoke from a party bowl's big load, and Hal can take every iota way down deep and hold his breath forever, so that even his exhalations are no more than slightly pale and sick sweet-smelling. Total utilization of available resources equals lack of publicly detectable waste. The Academy's tennis court's lungs pump room is underground and accessible only by tunnel. ETA is abundantly, embranchingly, tunneled. This is by design. Plus, one-hitters are small, which is good because, let's face it, anything you use to smoke high-resin dope with is going to stink. A bong is big, and its stink is going to be, like, commensurately big. Plus, you have the foul bong water to deal with. Pipes are smaller and at least portable, but they always come with only a multi-hit party bowl that disperses non-utilized smoke over a wide area. A one-hitter can be wastelessly employed, then allowed to cool, wrapped in two baggies, and then further wrapped and sealed in a Ziploc, and then enclosed in two sport socks, in a gear bag along with the lighter, and eye drops, and mint pellets, and the little film case of dope itself, and it's highly portable and odor-free, and basically totally covert. As far as Hal knows, colleagues Michael Pemulis, Jim Strzok, Bridget C. Boone, Jim Trolch, Ted Schacht, Trevor Axford, and possibly Kyle D. Coyle, and Tall Paul Shaw, and remotely, possibly, Franny Unwin, all know Hal gets regularly, covertly high. It's also not impossible that Bernadette Longley knows, actually. And of course the unpleasant K. Freer always has suspicions of all kinds. And Hal's brother Mario knows a thing or two, but that's it, in terms of public knowledge. But even though Pemulis and Strzok and Boone and Trolch and Axford, and occasionally, in a sort of medicinal and touristic way, Stice and Schacht, all are known to get high also, Hal has actually gotten actively high only with Pemulis, on the rare occasions he's gotten high with anybody else, as in person, which he avoids. He forgot. Ortho the Darkness Stice of Partridge, Kansas, knows. And Hal's oldest brother, Orin, mysteriously, even long distance, seems to know more than he's coming right out and saying, unless Hal's reading more into some of the phone comments than are there. Hal's mother, Mrs. Avril Incandenza, and her adoptive brother, Dr. Charles Tavis, the current ETA headmaster, both know Hal drinks alcohol sometimes, like on weekend nights with Trolch or maybe Axford, down the hill at clubs on Commonwealth Avenue. The Unexamined Life has its notorious blind bouncer night every Friday, where they card you on the honor system. Mrs. Avril Incandenza isn't crazy about the idea of Hal drinking, mostly because of the way his father had drunk when alive, and reportedly his father's own father before him in Arizona and California. But Hal's academic precocity, and especially his late competitive success on the junior circuit, make it clear that he's able to handle whatever modest amounts she's pretty sure he consumes. There's no way someone can seriously abuse a substance and perform at top, scholarly, and athletic levels, the ETA psych counselor Dr. Rusk assures her, especially the high-level athletic part. And Avril feels it's important that a concerned but unsmothering single parent know when to let go somewhat, and let the too high-functioning of her three sons make their own possible mistakes and learn from their own valid experience, no matter how much the secret worry about mistakes tears her gizzard out. The mother's. And Charles supports whatever personal decisions she makes in conscience about her children. And God knows she'd rather have Hal having a few glasses of beer every so often than absorbing God alone knows what sort of esoteric designer compounds with reptilian Michael Pemulis and trail of slime-leaving James Strzok, both of whom give Avril a howling case of the maternal phantods. And ultimately, she's told Doctors Rusk and Tavis, she'd rather have Hal abide in the security of the knowledge that his mother trusts him, that she's trusting and supportive and doesn't judge or gizzard tear or wring her fine hands over his having, for instance, a glass of Canadian ale with friends every now and again, and so works tremendously hard to hide her maternal dread of his possibly ever drinking like James himself or James's father, all so that Hal might enjoy the security of feeling that he can be upfront with her about issues like drinking, and not feel he has to hide anything from her under any circumstances. Dr. Tavis and Dolores Rusk have privately discussed the fact that, not least among the phobic stressors Avril suffers so uncomplainingly with, is a black phobic dread of hiding or secrecy in all possible forms with respect to her sons. Avril and C.T. know nothing about Hal's penchants for high-resin Bob Hope and underground absorption, which fact Hal obviously likes a lot on some level, though he's never given much thought to why. To why he likes it so much. ETA's hilltop grounds are traversable by tunnel. Avril I, for example, who never leaves the grounds anymore, rarely travels above ground, willing to hunch to take the off-tunnels between Headmaster's house and her office next to Charles Tavis's in the Community and Administration Building. A pink-bricked, white-pillared, Neo-Georgian thing that Hal's brother Mario says looks like a cube that has swallowed a ball too big for its stomach.
3.
Two sets of elevators and one of stairs run between the lobby, reception area, and administrative offices on ComEd's first floor and the weight room, sauna, and locker shower areas on the sub-level below it. One large tunnel of elephant-colored cement leads from just off the boys' showers to the mammoth laundry room below the west courts, and two smaller tunnels radiate from the sauna area south and east to the sub-basements of the smaller, spherocubular, proto-Georgian buildings, housing classrooms and sub-dormitories B and D. These two basements and smaller tunnels often serve as student storage space and hallways between various prorectors' private rooms.
4.
Then two even smaller tunnels, navigable by any adult willing to assume a kind of knuckle-dragging simian posture, in turn connect each of the sub-basements to the former optical and film development facilities of Leith and Ogilvy, and the late Dr. James O. Incandenza, now deceased, below and just west of the headmaster's house, from which facilities there's also a fair-diametered tunnel that goes straight to the lowest level of the Community and Administration Building. But its functions have gradually changed over 4 years, and it's now too full of exposed wiring and hot water pipes and heating ducts to be really passable. And to the offices of the physical plant, almost directly beneath the center row of ETA outdoor tennis courts, which offices and custodial lounge are in turn connected to ETA's lung storage and pump rooms via a pargeted tunnel hastily constructed by the Testar All-Weather Inflatable Structures Corp., which together with the folks over at the ATH-SCME, Industrial Air Displacement Devices, erects and services the inflatable dendrourethane dome, known as the lung, that covers the middle row of courts for the winter indoor season. The crude little rough-sided tunnel between plant and pump is traversable only via all-fours-type crawling and is essentially unknown to staff and administration, popular only with the Academy's smaller kids' tunnel club, as well as with certain adolescents with strong secret incentive to crawl on all fours. The long storage room is basically impassable from March through November because it's full of intricately folded dendrourethane lung material and dismantled sections of flexible ducting and fan blades, etc. The pump room is right next to it, but you have to crawl back out into the tunnel to get to it. On the engineering diagrams, the pump rooms may be about 20 meters directly beneath the centermost quartz in the middle row of quartz, and looks like a kind of spider hanging upside down. An unfenestrated oval chamber with six man-sized, curved ducts radiating up and out to exit points on the grounds above. And the pump room has six radial openings, one for each up-curving duct. Three 2-meter vents with huge turbine-bladed exhaust fans bolted into their grills, and three more 2Ms with reversed ATH-SCME intake fans that allow air from the ground above to be sucked down and around the room and up into the three exhaust vents. The pump room is essentially like a pulmonary organ, or the epicenter of a massive 6-vectored wind tunnel, and when activated roars like a banshee that slammed its hand in the door, though the PR's in full legit operation only when the lung is up, usually November to March. The intake fans pull ground-level winter air down into and around the room and through the three exhaust fans and up the outtake ducts into networks of pneumatic tubing in the lung's sides and dome. It's the pressure of the moving air that keeps the fragile lung inflated. When the quartz lung is down and stored, Hal will descend and walk and then hunch his way in to make sure nobody's in the physical plant quarters. Then he'll hunch and crawl to the PR, gear bag in his teeth, and activate just one of the big exhaust fans and get secretly high and exhale palely through its blades into the vent, so that any possible odor is blown through an outtake duct and expelled through a grilled hole on the west side of the west corner.